Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Vitamins were only discovered by scientists about 100 years ago. Now, Americans spend an estimated $32 billion on vitamins and nutritional supplements each year. In a new book, science writer Catherine Price chronicles the American fascination with health in a pill. The title of her book is Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. Catherine Price joins me in the studio. You're welcome, as always, to be part of the program. Give us a call at 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Catherine Price, it's good to meet you.
It's wonderful to be here.
Thank you. Catherine, in your book, you say there's really no definition of what a vitamin is. Explain that.
That was one of the strangest things I came across in the early stages of my research, was an inability to just come up with a concrete definition. So the first thing I would say is that when we, the public, talk about vitamins, we often conflate vitamins and dietary supplements, and these are two very different things. There's actually only 13 chemicals that are known as human vitamins, but there's an estimated 85,000 dietary supplements in the U.S. market. So I just want to establish that first off, because it's really easy to get confused between those two things. With that said, there's actually no precise chemical definition of what makes something a vitamin. They're lumped together in large part because of historical happenstance. But the working definition that's helpful is it's, you know, a dietary chemical or a chemical that we need in very small amounts to prevent a deficiency that usually comes from food.
That usually comes from food.
Usually.
So, I mean, broccoli, for example, we get lots of vitamin C.
Uh-huh.
Orange juice, lots of vitamin C. Milk, added vitamin D and A. How come?
Why the added stuff? Yes. Well, I should also clarify to your point just a second ago that usually comes from food. Now, coming more and more from food because so much stuff is added to our food. But the reason that vitamin D is added to milk really is in part because it's just very difficult to get vitamin D in particular from our diets. It is a very strange vitamin. And many people don't believe it actually was originally meant to be gotten from food at all, because basically fish liver oil and certain kinds of fish are the highest concentrated sources. We're able to make it in response to sunlight in a chemical process in our skin. But these days, many of us, I certainly do not see the sun very often, especially during the winter. And while no one knows precisely how much of D we need, we probably aren't getting enough from sun exposure in certain latitudes. So to answer your question, while there's no vitamin fortification that's mandatory in the United States at the time, there are certain products like bread or I should say flour and milk that do have additional vitamins for the purpose of preventing deficiency in the general population.
So how did we get to a point where Americans now spend $32 billion a year on vitamins?
Well, again, that's dietary supplements. Vitamins, oh no, she's looking very sad. The latest vitamin figures I have are that Americans are spending about $11 billion on vitamins.
Okay.
And actually, the dietary supplement estimate for 2013 has been raised to about $36 billion, so even more. How we got to this point is a pretty long story that was kind of the, you know, thrust of the book, but we started off with these 13 vitamins. We discovered that they were essential. They proved to be miraculous if you gave someone with a vitamin deficiency a vitamin, saved their life. They also are naturally found in food, so they developed this aura of being quote-unquote natural, for whatever that means. And in general, it's hard if you're eating food, nearly impossible to overdose on vitamins in food. When I say food, I mean food that naturally contains vitamins. So they had this huge health halo and a bit of the miraculous about them, both of which were, you know, largely justified in the case of vitamins found naturally in foods. But through a century of food marketing and a lot of very clever maneuvering by the supplement industry, that health halo got expanded to the much, much larger category of dietary supplements that's led to this enormous industry.
So the question becomes, how many of us really need to take either vitamins or dietary supplements?
Well, the second category is probably easier because dietary supplements are not normally essential, meaning we don't really need them. I mean, people come up with plenty of reasons that they take 15 pills a day.
Absolutely.
15, even more. So that's the reason with the dietary supplements. I don't know, for the vitamins, whether or not we need to take them, it depends in context. I mean, a lot of people are getting plenty of vitamins from the food that they're eating. And when I say the food that they're eating, I both mean the people among us who exist primarily on like kale, you know, but also people who are just eating a lot of fortified products, products like breakfast cereal or vitamin waters or, you know, some bread products made with enriched flour. And for those people, they're essentially taking a multivitamin just by eating the food because there's synthetic vitamins in the food. So they probably don't need to be taking one. So I would restrict the category of people who should be taking vitamin supplements to those who have a medical necessity or a lifestyle choice that requires them to.
But apparently new research says that many people are taking too many vitamins, too much vitamins. What's happening?
What's happening in terms of why they're doing that, or what can it do to them?
Both. Both.
Well, they're doing it in part because Americans really like taking pills. They're also doing it in part because it's become very trendy to have products that are fortified with extra vitamins far in excess of what you could get from food or what the recommended dietary allowances are. So things like vitamin drinks or sports drinks or energy bars or whatever else, you know, those can have many times the RDA for vitamins just in those products. When you combine those with, say, a daily multivitamin, and then you combine that with the other foods that have all of these synthetic vitamins added to them, you can get to really high levels. So that's how that happened, or is happening.
And what effect, what impact can that have on our bodies?
Well, I think that the scary thing is that we don't know. You know, foods have been fortified with extra vitamins since the 30s and 40s, but not to this degree. This is really a huge trend of having, I mean, vitamin water is the obvious example that comes to mind because of the name, but where it's very easy to get large doses. So we don't really know what the effect long-term is going to be. We're kind of embarking on a nationwide nutritional experiment, you know, without any sense of the potential risks there. I mean, in general, I would say that vitamins, if you're just talking about vitamins, the good thing in a day-to-day sense is that for the water-soluble vitamins, you'll probably excrete them. I just put a lot of caveats into that sentence. But, you know, people always say, oh, Americans have the most expensive urine in the world. Doesn't really matter. We're wasting our time with these multivitamins, and it's totally, you know, whatever. The worst that happens is you just waste your money. And that's not necessarily true. First of all, in the case of fat-soluble vitamins, which is A, D, E, and K, particularly A, which can be very toxic to your liver in high doses in the short term. But we also don't really know what the consequence is of saturating your system with the other vitamins day in and day out. You know, C, yeah, you'll pee out a lot of C, but if you're doing that every day, you're making your body process all of this extra chemical. Who knows what happens? Because a vitamin only acts as a vitamin up to the point that you need it to act as a vitamin. I mean, then it's more of a free-floating potential drug. Like, it still could be doing stuff, but we don't know what. And the other thing I'd point out in terms of vitamins in particular in this sense is that vitamins regulate other things that our bodies do. For example, vitamin D is necessary for calcium absorption. It plays a crucial role in that. If you don't have enough vitamin D, you won't have strong bones. You'll develop the disease of rickets. But the converse is if you have too much D, which is one of the fat-soluble vitamins, you could absorb too much calcium out of your food. And that could cause calcification in places you don't want to have, calcium deposits like your kidneys or your arteries. Or C helps with iron, and you don't want to have too much iron.
You know, it's interesting. I heard someone say the other day that in order to have any impact on your thinking, your brain power, you would need to take perhaps as many as 16,000 milligrams of vitamin D, which has been recommended for better brain power.
I don't actually think vitamin D has been recommended for brain power, so I would challenge your friend on that. I mean, the current Institute of Medicine recommendations for D are based only on bone health. What I was just talking about with calcium absorption.
Sure.
Granted, there's a lot of research and other stuff going on with D, and much of it, you know, or some of it may well be proven eventually, but not now. But I will say that what strikes me about that comment is the idea that you would have to take so much of it, right? So that's more than you're going to get from sun, because your body naturally stops making vitamin D at a point. Lifeguards are not suffering from toxicity from D.
And yeah. Indeed, Catherine Price, she's science and health writer, and her new book is titled Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. Short break. We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Carbonite, providing secure backup and recovery for businesses and homes. Since 2005, Carbonite has backed up more than 500 billion files, from email servers to family photos. Learn more at carbonite.com. And from Angie's List, providing online access to ratings and reviews of local companies to help consumers achieve their home improvement goals, whether that be a remodeled kitchen, a freshly painted house, or a new backyard. Learn more at angieslist.com.
Welcome back. Catherine Price is the author of a new book. It's titled Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. And we want to hear about the vitamins and supplements that you buy. You can take our poll at drshow.org. We'll have results for you within the hour. So once again, go to drshow.org and take our poll. When did we begin adding vitamin supplements to food, Catherine?
We began adding vitamins to foods basically when it became possible to add vitamins to foods, which was in the 30s and the 40s. Because as I was saying, I mean, the first vitamin to be actually chemically isolated was thiamine in 1926. So the steps to a discovery of a vitamin are, you know, suspecting it exists and then figuring out where it exists and then isolating it from food and then figuring out how to make a version that you can add back. So there was a time constraint on that. When this started happening in the 30s and the 40s, what was interesting about that, it was also around the same time as the growth of the modern American food system and the idea of packaged and processed foods that could be transported over long distances and stay shelf stable, not go bad, not go rancid for long periods of time. The thing that happens when you create these products is that unfortunately the same refinement that's necessary to give them long shelf lives often destroys the vitamins and other natural compounds that they contain. And so when at first food companies kind of denied this was happening. They were like, oh, no, it's totally fine. You know, sometimes they even said their new products were better than the ones that came before. But eventually it became obvious that the public was going to catch on at some point that that these vitamins and other things had been destroyed. And at that point, the food industry started to embrace vitamins and add them to their products and then use those added vitamins as marketing points. And what I think is interesting is that because of this timing, because the food marketers and companies basically started doing this just on the cusp of when the public might have really fully recognized what was happening, they've never fully had to admit that their products would be nutritionally, you know, inferior were it not for these added vitamins. So the analogy I came up with in the book is, you know, it's kind of like having a repentant thief who replaces the family silver before anyone realized it was gone, you know, and then somehow made himself seem better afterwards.
Right. Tell me why you got interested in this whole vitamin issue.
The literal answer to that question is that I was on a bus with my husband, and he turned to me. He comes up with a lot of my ideas, I should say. And he turned to me and he said, "What's a vitamin?" And I opened my mouth to try to give him an answer, and nothing came out. Like, all I could think, it was like a stream of consciousness. I was like, vitamin C, oranges, scurvy, explorers, teeth, rotting gums. So basically it was like what I knew in third grade and nothing more. And he said, "You should write a book about that," you know, and then turned to stare out the window. And
of course,
3-4 years later, here we are.
So, but didn't it also come from your own health problems?
Yes. So I think the reason that his question resonated with me so much, and I did not just go back to staring out the window, but instead started obsessively making notes in my journal, was that when I was 22 years old, I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, which is an autoimmune disease. It's different from the much more prevalent type 2. Type 1 basically occurs when your immune system kills off the cells in your pancreas that make a hormone called insulin, and you need insulin to absorb energy from your food. Basically, living with type 1 diabetes means you have to constantly give yourself manual insulin by injection to balance your blood sugar. It's very demanding. It's very constant. There's no cure, and it requires constant, you know, attention and constant failure because you never get it as perfectly right as your body would do on its own. But anyway, having type 1 made me change the way I thought about food, because for me, food went from something that was just something I ate to something that contained a blend of macronutrients that were going to affect my blood sugar, particularly carbohydrate. So I really started breaking food down into chemical parts of my own mind. And that got me interested in writing about health and nutrition in general. But for whatever reason, I'd never taken it the next step down to think about micronutrients like vitamins. So there's this huge gap in my knowledge, despite the fact that I spend so much time thinking about food.
So you went from thinking about the popularity of vitamins and how it led to the growth of all these other nutritional supplements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, as I was saying, I think the fact that vitamins were miraculous and they do exist in nature, and for the most part, vitamins are not going to hurt you. It got extended to this much bigger category of supplements. And a lot of that started happening in the 1970s and then later in the 1990s with a series of laws that were passed, for which the industry did a really great job of using the word vitamin to mean much more than just vitamins, and convincing the public that their access to these vitamins was a matter of personal freedom, and that they were going to have their freedoms taken away from them if these substances were to be regulated more stringently.
And did you feel as you went along that there should be some regulation here?
Well, I should clarify, there is regulation around dietary supplements. The supplement industry will jump on you if you say there's no regulation. The FDA is in charge of regulating them. But the way that they are regulated is much different from how you or I might assume that they're regulated and how you or I, definitely I, think that they should be regulated. And the most striking example of this is that dietary supplements are not required to be tested for safety or for efficacy before they're sold. So no one's out there making sure that your, I don't know, ginkgo biloba or whatever it is you're taking, or proprietary product that has like a name that has nothing to do with its actual ingredients, you know, is actually safe or doing what it says to.
Aura has in it what it says it's supposed to have in it?
Well, in terms of having what it says it has in it, there are rules about that. There are general manufacturing practices that went into full effect in 2010. And that is an attempt to ensure that products actually do have what they say in the labels. With that said, there are a lot of problems with how companies are actually following those GMPs. The latest figures I was just reading this morning from an industry publication was that FDA was finding 70% percent of the firms that it actually, you know, went into investigate had some sort of violation, and that it was an average of 7 violations per firm. And if you want to go further with that, if you want to actually find out more about what's in your supplements, which, by the way, is really hard to do. People always ask me, how can I pick a good vitamin? How can I pick a good supplement? You can't do it just by looking at the labels. So you really have to do your own research if you want to take supplements and be safe about it. I particularly like a company called ConsumerLab.com, and it's one of the only companies that actually pulls products randomly off store shelves and evaluates them to see if they have what they say they have. They're not testing for safety. They're not testing for efficacy. They're just trying to prove or, you know, find out if these things actually have what they say. And they find a surprising percentage of products don't.
And indeed, I think a recent survey showed exactly that.
There have been a lot of headlines about the New York Attorney General launching a big investigation into herbal supplements in particular. That's a little bit complicated of a story because the supplement industry has pushed back, saying that they used the wrong testing methods. And so far, the Attorney General has not responded really adequately to that. So there are questions about the testing methods. But that's kind of a red herring in my view, because if you look at places like Consumer Lab, several other places that do the right kind of testing, there's a huge, huge problem. Recently, Consumer Lab found that for aloe vera products, 50% of the products they tested did not have aloe vera, for example. They found that 40% of the garlic supplements failed in their tests. 75% of the ashwagandha supplements failed their tests. And when I say failed their tests, I mean didn't have the substance in the quantity that it claimed, or had some kind of contaminant that was not on the label, or didn't disintegrate properly in your body, which clearly you want because otherwise you will just have expensive urine, or had some other kind of labeling problem. So there's real reason for concern.
Catherine Price, her new book is titled Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. And joining us now by phone, Duffy Mackay. He's Senior Vice President of Scientific and Regulatory Affairs for the Council for Responsible Nutrition. Thanks for joining us, sir.
Well, it's great to be here.
Thank you. Give me your reaction to this book, Duffy Mackay.
Well, overall, it is a good philosophical discussion of the food supply, but we think it really lacks some practical applications. It's really not based in the real world. For example, you guys were just discussing theoretical concerns about getting too much, when in fact we just saw this week the Dietary Guidelines for Americans came out. And the Dietary Guidelines, they look at what we eat in America, including fortified food and supplements. And they've, lo and behold, found that Americans fall short in 10 key nutrients. And 4 of these nutrients are so low that they're of public health concern. And these are not just the 13 essential nutrients. These are things like fiber. You know, we don't get enough fiber in our diet. And therefore, you could add a dietary supplement to fill that gap.
What's your reaction to the New York Attorney General test that some supplements did not contain what was actually on the label?
Well, Catherine was spot on this one. The New York Attorney General is frankly wrong. He has performed the wrong test. Many people have come forward that are experts in the field and highlighted the fact that the test he did was wrong. And we are it's our understanding that the correct tests have been performed and those results have been shared with the Attorney General. But unfortunately, he's not willing to be transparent and share his methodology. And therefore, at this point, we can only assume his test is bogus.
Catherine, do you want to weigh in on that?
I can weigh in on both, but to do the second one first, that is the issue. They may have used the wrong test, but I think it's a red herring, and I think it's actually a great gift for people who don't want to acknowledge the problems in the industry. To give another example, there's a problem in the dietary supplement industry with adulteration with illegal drugs. So, for example, a couple of years ago, the FDA commissioner sent a letter to dietary supplement manufacturers in which she explained that they were finding things like beta blockers, sexual enhancement drugs like Viagra, anticoagulants, illegal stimulants, all these things in dietary supplement products that were not revealed on the label because clearly they're illegal. That people were taking, and it has real-world consequences. For example, there are problems where athletes, the anti-doping agency has to warn athletes to be very, very careful about their supplements because they can think they're doing everything right and then test positive on a drug test. And this has actually destroyed, you know, the chances of some would-be Olympic athletes because they can't be in the Olympics.
Yeah, I agree. These are real problems, and those are not dietary supplements. Those are illegal products that are masquerading as dietary supplements. The people doing that are not dietary supplement companies. They are criminals, and we work directly with FDA to do everything we can to make sure those people end up behind bars. Those are not dietary supplements. It's an unfortunate and sad shadow industry that we are putting resources into eradicating. That practice needs to stop, and those are not dietary supplements and should not be part of a conversation about nutrition and vitamins and fiber and omega-3s, because frankly, that's illegal. Those people need to go to jail.
I'm glad you agree on that, but I would say that they actually do, their products do fall under the legal category of dietary supplements.
That's incorrect. In fact, as soon as you put an adulterant that's an approved pharmaceutical ingredient, that product is no longer regulated by the division of FDA that deals with food. It goes right over to the side that deals with drugs, and those products are treated as
That is very, very
drugs.
True, but I would say that they're sold in a GNC with the dietary supplements because no one knows that they have these things in them.
Those products should never be in GNC. Those products are typically online, available at some random website that's promoting illegal garbage.
So I just say people should look at ConsumerLab.com,
exactly.
Do some searching online, and decide what you agree with.
So, Duffy, in your view, how can we as consumers make sure that what companies say is in the pills is true if there's no federal testing for them?
There is federal testing. Catherine mentioned good manufacturing practices, and these are the federal laws that say that all material coming into a facility must be tested for identity, and then all finished products need to be tested for purity and potency. So,
but what about pre-market approval, as we do for pharmaceutical drugs?
Well, that's an interesting philosophical discussion, but as we know, it's an average of about $4 billion to have a drug approved. And so to get something like whey protein or omega-3 and spend $4 billion to get it approved, but because these are commodity ingredients, there's no patent protection, you don't get the same financial incentives to spend that $4 billion on getting it approved, and therefore it just doesn't make sense to do that with vitamin C. And these products, the ingredients, the legal ingredients, have an overwhelmingly safe profile. Vitamin C is safe.
Just to be clear, the FDA itself does not do the testing, Catherine.
The GMPs set the rules for what the companies are supposed to be doing, and for the most
general manufacturers.
Yeah, general manufacturing practices. And then the FDA comes in and does an inspection to begin with to see if they've got the if they are doing what they say they're doing, and also to see if they are following the rules correctly.
So, Duffy, if the FDA does not actually test the supplements, how can we, as consumers, know they're safe?
Well, there's a variety of tools in the toolbox. The first one is common sense. You know, if you see a claim that's too good to be true, that's a red flag. The others are to buy from brands you know and trust. There's brands that they have their name and reputation to stand by, so they are going to be 100% compliant with good manufacturing practices. Beyond that, if you're an athlete or if you're someone who's really wanting to be conservative, there are third-party seals organizations like United States Pharmacopeia or NSF that actually do independent testing of the product and give the product their seal of approval that says it doesn't have banned substances, it has the ingredients it's supposed to, and, you know, essentially gives you that sense of somebody other than the company has analyzed this thoroughly and I give it my seal.
Catherine?
Yeah, I would say that I think a common technique of people who are defending the industry is to kind of go towards these fringes. And it's definitely true. Those are some of the biggest problems. But, for example, on these aloe vera tests that that Consumer Lab did, one of the most reputable manufacturers of fish oil was found to have no aloe vera in its product. So sometimes they're even duped.
All right. Well, I have to leave it at that. Debbie McKay, thanks for joining us. He is with the Scientific and Regulatory Affairs for the Council for Responsible Nutrition. Short break. We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Constant Contact, committed to helping small businesses succeed with email and online marketing tools. For organizations to promote their business through newsletters, events, surveys, and social media. More at constantcontact.com. From the Joyce Foundation, working to ensure that every student has an excellent teacher and every teacher has exceptional support. More information is available online at joycefdn.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
On the next Fresh Air, The Quest to Stay Young. We talk with Bill Gifford, author of Spring Chicken, about the science of fighting aging and the history of purported cures, ranging from goat testicle implantation to vitamin supplements.
Anybody who says that they have the magic secret is probably lying to you and trying to sell you something.
We'll also learn what might just help. Join us.
And welcome back. As I mentioned earlier, we've been taking a poll at our website about vitamins that you take and supplements you buy. So according to the poll so far at our website, 76% of those who responded take some sort of vitamin or dietary supplement. Of that group, 62% take multivitamins. About a third take herbal supplements. 36% if you started taking vitamins or supplements at the recommendation of a doctor. Another 27% began to use them because of an article or research paper. And you can still weigh in yourself at our website, drshow.org. We'll have full results for you tomorrow. And now joining us by phone from San Francisco, David Kessler, former commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration and author of The end of overeating. He's now a professor at the University of California at San Francisco. David Kessler, it's good to hear from you.
It's always good to be with you, Diane.
Thank you. Tell me your reaction to the various studies indicating people are getting too little vitamins and some people are getting way too much.
You know, I think Catherine Price did an excellent job in her book because she underscored one essential point. There's still so much we don't know about vitamins. You know, I took care of a patient in the last couple of weeks who had very severe neuropathy, nerve damage, because of a lack of vitamin B12. Now, that person had some medical complications. Right? We know, I worked very hard to fortify the food supply with folic acid to prevent neural tube defects in babies that were born. So we know that vitamins and minerals play an essential role,
sure.
In certain instances.
Absolutely. But I wonder if you were surprised by the recent studies in New York that supplements did not contain what was on the label.
Regrettably, no. Every 5 years there are these studies. I did these studies when I was commissioner back in the 1990s.
I remember.
Right? And I went in front of Congress, and I had all these bottles in front of me. And I said, the information on the bottles, we can't trust. We can't trust what's in the bottle to be what's on the label. Congress enacted the dietary supplement laws. It made, Diane, the fight against tobacco look easy compared to the fight against dietary supplements.
So you believe that the dietary supplement should be more tightly related, but the industry argues that consumers would not have access to a wide variety of supplements if that industry were more regulated.
You know, that's been the industry's mantra. We took the position that what's on the label should be in the product. We also took the position that any claims that are made should be supported by scientific evidence. The industry turned that around and said, FDA is going after your vitamins. Congress, the fact is, Congress should, they pass the laws. We have to respect that. Drugs are very tightly regulated. Food has regulations. Congress made the decision not to impose. There are some. There's no doubt FDA could go after some of these vitamins that don't have what they're supposed to have. The problem is it's low on the priority. But Congress made a decision to set the bar on dietary supplements, and it set it low. I respect that. That's Congress's right.
And how do you feel about that, Catherine?
About the
congressional regulation, FDA oversight.
Well, I would like to see it more strict than it is. I agree. Congress makes the laws and FDA has to follow the laws related to it. But one interesting thing I was going to say in response to, how the drugs in America are regulated. I think that when the supplement industry talks about this, they're kind of comparing the current state of regulation for supplements to a prescription drug that does cost billions of dollars in an average of 12 years to get approved. But the next time any of you guys out there brush your teeth or use an anti-dandruff shampoo or put antiperspirant on your armpits, look on the back of that, and you're going to see that it says drug facts on it. Because there are standards in place to make sure that, for example, your Head and Shoulders doesn't peel your skin off every time you try to reduce your flakes or whatever. And I don't think many people would argue that their deodorant or their Head and Shoulders or the toothpaste is outrageously expensive and preventing them from having access to it.
Do you think that the public itself is partially to blame for how supplements are regulated?
I think you could create a circle of blame here where, the industry, as I was saying before, did a really great job of making people think of vitamins and all supplements as the same thing and framing it as a matter of personal freedom. As a result of that, the public got incredibly engaged. And Dr. Kessler can speak a lot more to this because he's a U.S. commissioner, and sent millions of letters in getting Congress to pass this law. And we vote for Congress. So, I mean, you know, it's a circle of blame, but it's not going to change without consumers doing something.
Dr. Kessler.
You know, I wonder whether the industry would be better off and actually make more money if there were tighter regulations. Because at the end of the day, you know, we walk in to a health store, we walk on the supermarket aisles, and there's so much we don't know. If we had good information, if the industry were required to do those studies, I think it would sell many more products because there would be a great deal of credibility. The problem is we don't have a lot of that information.
I want to ask both of you a question. We've got many emails about this on and Twitter. Questions about prenatal vitamins. Here's one example from Joanna in Houston, Texas, who says, when I was pregnant, I actually went on a short trip to Norway. In my haste to pack, I forgot my prenatal vitamins. I ventured out and tried to find some. There was none to be found. On the contrary, I got the strangest looks from people I was asking about prenatal vitamins that it made me think they don't even use them there. Are we crazy? Catherine?
No, there is actually a reason that prenatal vitamins are important, but the reason has to do with folic acid, which is vitamin B9.
Which Dr. Kessler mentioned, yes.
Yes, so B9 or folic acid, which is the synthetic form, is very important in or prevent makes it more likely that the neural tube of a developing embryo is going to close correctly. The neural tube is the part of the embryo that turns into the brain and the nervous system of the baby. You do not want that to develop incorrectly. So the issue becomes if you don't have enough folic acid in your system at the time that tube might close, you can end up with devastating birth defects. One thing people often don't realize is that this happens so early in pregnancy, often by the 28th day, it can happen before you realize you're pregnant. So if you're thinking of having a baby, if you're of childbearing age and there's a chance you might have a baby, you do want to pay attention to folic acid.
Where does folic acid show up in the food chain, Dr. Kessler?
We fortified the food supply to make sure that the American diet has adequate supplies of folic acid. But no doubt, a woman of childbearing years should be on folic acid. Diane, it's one of the great public health successes. It's one of the things I am proudest of. We have reduced the incidence of very great disability, spina bifida, by a significant percentage because, one, we fortified the food supply, and two, we've gotten out the words. Folic acid is very important for a healthy pregnancy.
All right. I want to open the phones here. I want to go first to Robert in Kento, Ohio. You're on the air.
Diane, thank you very much. It's a delight to hear you. And I'm a retired osteopathic physician. My father started my brother and me on Catalin tablets made by a company named Standard Process up in Palmyra, Wisconsin. Let me go further. My father died at 81. My mother died at 103. So I'm sure there's some genetic factors here. But I'm 90 years old now. I've been taking Catalin tablets since I was I was born 1924. So it was early, sometime in the mid-30s, I started taking these because my father also wanted us to be well-nourished. These are not synthetic vitamins. They're all natural from ground-up animal tissue and plant supplements.
So you're feeling awfully good about those, I gather. Dr. Kessler, do you know what this vitamin is?
Yeah, so, at 90 years of age, do whatever you've been doing. but understand, unfortunately, we don't have any control, so we don't know the data. Again, I think that's the thing that strikes me. There's so much we don't know. We have no idea of the efficacy. I am sure the caller does a lot of other things, right? I mean, that supports healthy behavior. And maybe the reason that he's doing so well is because of those other things. So we don't know.
All right, let's go to Daniel in Arlington, Virginia. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. How are you today?
Good.
This is actually my first time calling your show, and I want you to know that you are thoroughly awesome. I listen to you every day.
Thank you.
So my question to your guest is, and more in particular towards Ms. Price, I've gone through a pretty substantial amount of weight loss, and one of the things that I took during that process was vitamin B12. Now, I'm not attributing any success to it. It simply seemed to correlate to some success for me. That being said, it basically espouses a heightened metabolism and brain function, and my curiosity is the amount of a individual dose, and it's usually advertised at 5,000 mcg. Are there any studies correlating to potential side effects to that, or as for your conversation earlier, to any excessive amounts of having a vitamin in your system in general?
Because and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Go ahead, Catherine.
Well, I cannot speak to what role B12 played in your personal weight loss. I would doubt that it was attributed or that they were really correlated, because those are not things that B12 is known to do. What I will say is that I'm really pretty surprised by that dosage that you mentioned, because the actual recommended dietary allowance for B12 is 2.4 micrograms. And I believe you just said that your supplement contained 5,000. So I can't tell you what doing 5,000, micrograms of B12 a day will do. But I personally wouldn't feel comfortable taking a dose that much in excess of what my body needs.
All right, let's go to Judy in Kalamazoo, Michigan. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a philosopher and an organic farmer, and I think a lot about the nature of what we put in our bodies. And one thing that I'm concerned about with the increased regulations on dietary supplements, it's not just, you keep saying that the industry is being regulated, but the industry includes a lot of people who are practicing native or indigenous medicine. A lot of those types of cures, they don't operate scientifically. It's an ancient practice. And it's just different than science. And I know that we have an inclination to constantly regulate everything using scientific procedures. But I would be concerned about the regulation hurting other types of medicine that I find very important, and I know that a lot of Americans do too.
Dr. Kessler.
I think we do need to be respectful of the diversity of opinions. But the fact is, if you're going to sell a product today, what's on the label should be in the bottle. We take that for granted. When we look at the label, we assume that what's on the label is in the product. And that didn't happen without a lot of hard work. And that was the result of regulation. Are there costs to regulation? Of course. But in this day and age, I think science and good manufacturing is paramount.
Yeah, and I would follow that up by saying that I think that it sounds like your fear would be you wouldn't have access to these potential treatments. And like Dr. Kessler was saying, it's really more about just making sure that when you want to treat someone with these things, that you actually know it is what it actually says.
What it says.
But I will say that is a very common tactic used by industry to get people riled up, because they'll have people like you with really great intentions, And then being told that, oh my goodness, or you conclude that, oh, this might take away my access to this thing I really believe in. And then that's used to lessen the regulation that in a way would actually be helpful, because then you'd be able to use these products knowing that they actually were what they say.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Catherine Price, her new book is titled Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. Dr. David Kessler, former commissioner at the Food and Drug Administration. He is author of The End of Overeating. Thank you, Catherine, for being with us. Thank you, Dr. Kessler. Good to talk with you both.
Thank you.
And thanks all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Yurblifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.